You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for June 24th, 2016. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live while the revolution is periscoped, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Other openings that we were working on this week that got preempted by the periscoping of Congress.
Which is happening right now.
We are recording Wednesday night while they're sitting on the, literally sitting on the House floor. So we'll be talking about that in a minute, but I don't want to let these go.
No,
you know, we're murdering our darlings here and we really don't want to.
No.
The one you had was recorded live from the Lil Marco booth at the annual Conservative Political Reinvention Fair.
Yes.
The Professional Left, okay. Yeah, you have to lose the E in the audio. I know sometimes that happens too, but it's spelled F-A-I-R-E in our notes.
Because this was the week that Lil Marco announced he's going to sell out the one principal he had left. So that was exciting. And then you had...
Well, I had a couple. One I had was recorded live from the protest barricade at the Brexit, Donald Trump, Celebrity Golf Classic, and Weenie Roast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I also had recorded live while keeping up with Corey Lewandowski's LinkedIn page. Now, see, that really is a close second runner-up.
It really
is. Because the revolution is periscoped, we had to blow that out of the water.
Thanks, John Lewis.
The only place that's having more action this week than the floor of the House of Representatives is Corey Lewandowski's LinkedIn page.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's really win-win for him, frankly. You know,
Because if it
goes south, if Donald Trump is somehow not elected president of the United States.
It's because they let him go.
It's because they let him go.
If Donald they didn't Trump, let Trump be Trump.
You, I told you, but you didn't listen to me. You listened to that other man who was full of blandishments and bought you ice cream. But if Trump does go on to become president, Corey Lewandowski can say, I was the first stage of that rocket.
Yeah.
I got him to a position where he could leave orbit.
Yep.
And without me, there is no Donald Trump presidency. So really, now is the... What happened to him involuntarily is what the rest of the Republican Party wants to have happen to them on purpose.
Which is to somehow be absolved of responsibility.
They want to be detached and they want him to go away. They want to part company with him somehow, and he just won't let them. He's wrapping himself around them like Matt Taibbi's vampire squid.
Well, it's ironic that you should say that because that's sort of really where Marco Rubio is.
It is.
Completely. With his, I'm going to run, but you know why I'm going to run is because I can stand up. I have proven that I stand up to Trump.
Yeah.
So if he's elected, I've already said, can you imagine if Hillary Clinton said, I'm running for president because I know from the inside just how bad things are in the Obama administration, and nobody will be able to clean it up better than me.
Man.
I've seen it firsthand.
All that shit you see on Breitbart, you don't know the half of how awful it is. But I've seen it up close, people.
And yet, here's a direct quote from
Marco.
Mm-hmm. He says, after missing a third of the votes in the Senate, you know, and being called upon to resign by the Sun Sentinel because he doesn't show up for work. The prospect of a Trump presidency is worrisome to me. It's no secret that I have significant disagreements with Donald Trump. His positions on many key issues are still unknown. And some of his statements, especially about women and minorities, I find not just offensive, but unacceptable. If he is elected, we will need senators willing to encourage him in the right direction.
Encourage him.
If necessary, stand up to him.
Uh-huh.
I've proven a willingness to do both.
Yes. By bravely never showing up to work.
By bravely never showing up to work only almost two-thirds of the time.
Yeah. And while while I'm not at work, I spend a lot of my time on talk radio talking about a shithole the Senate is and what a waste of time it is. And oh my God, it's the worst job I've ever had. It's just a time-wasting bunch of old assholes.
You know who's shown a much better ability to stand up to Donald Trump? Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton's doing really good at that.
Really good. much better than you, Marco.
And you know, there's a current, you know, in the complaining chorus on the right, there is, mm-hmm. well, Hillary said in 2008 she wasn't going to run for president. So, you know, yeah, you're right. 7 years before, she did say, you know what, I don't think I'm going to do this again. Mm-hmm. Marco Rubio said he's never going to run for the Senate less than a month ago.
Because he hates it.
Less than a fucking month ago. He
Hillary
said
Clinton did not say, I hate the presidency.
Right.
I hate the White House. So I don't want to run because I hate. She didn't say while she was sitting in the White House as First Lady and Secretary of State, I hate it here.
I hate it here. After she lost and she was exhausted.
And she had,
you know, some amount of time to think about it. She said, you know, I don't think I'm going to run again. I don't believe I will. And that's fine. And then many years later, she looked at the field and looked at her options and saw, hey, there's an opening. I'm probably going to win. Sure, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. But Rubio, it was in May. Yeah. It was in May that he said, no, never, never, never. I've told you 10. He said, like, I told you 10,000 times already, Sean, I'm not going to do it. And really, the only principle he had left, he sold them all out. He dumped them all overboard, was I'm not going to run again. I'm not going to run again. I'm going to go home and become a citizen. So he sold out the last, quote unquote, principle he had left. On the other hand, it is Florida.
The Florida Republican Party has no other options.
Right.
Everybody else completely loses to Chris Murphy's from Connecticut. Right. I'm sorry.
Patrick Murphy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or Alan Grayson.
Or Alan Grayson. There is going to be a primary in August.
Yeah.
But just so you know, Obama and Biden have both made radio ads for Murphy already for the primary. Yeah. So it's like, yeah. And what I find ironic about this whole thing is that the Republican Party, with its continual obstruction of the Obama administration, mm-hmm. has given Obama and Biden and Mrs. Obama little else to do but campaign against you for the next 6 months.
Congratulations. You know.
So, you know, apart from mass shootings and tragedies and weather disasters and, you know, whatever else comes up that does need to be dealt with by the executive. They got nothing but time, baby, to record radio ads for your opponents.
You have told them we're not going to ever do anything. We're not going to pass anything. So great. OK, this is what we're going to do for the next 6 months. Right. And this is sort of the theme of our show this week is sort of tear down this wall, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah.
The Republican Party that is too cowardly to call a vote on gun slaughter in the United States in the House of Representatives is the party of Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, they really are. They're just NRA dung beetles showing their ass to the world. And this is what we've been talking about. That's who they are. They're way too fucking cowardly to even call for, even if you don't agree that this law should pass. Even if you think a no-fly list is an inherently unconstitutional instrument and basing any law off of that is a bad idea, fine. Let's debate that as a component of a bill. But we're not going to even call the bill because we are owned. We are completely, wholly owned. And I was thinking, you know, Trump is the hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And this sit-in is the anvil.
Yeah.
And there's no way – I mean, I say no way, knowing full well that the Beltway media and the Republican leadership will find a way to just forget about this, distract you from it. Let's have another Benghazi hearing, whatever it takes to get this off the front pages. Mm-hmm. But it has finally come down to I don't need to debate anymore with anybody. I just point to Trump and point to the House Republican leadership and say – we told you so. That's the Republican Party. Donald Trump is the fucking Republican Party. Paul Ryan is the cowardly, craven douchebag who leads a party of cowardly, craven, bloodthirsty, bought-off assholes who are collectively, Donald Trump and the rest of them, are the Republican Party. And you know who's at fault for the Republican Party? The Republican voter.
Yep.
Finally.
And I wanted to point to this article that MSNBC did, Benji Sarlin at MSNBC did, called The United States of Trump, where he really technically looked at who the Trump voter is. And the perception, the kind of general perception in the media is, well, it's blue collar, disaffected workers, overwhelmingly white, somewhat racist, men who are not part of the establishment, don't like establishment politicians, perhaps have never voted in a primary before, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And what their analysis of this is that, yes, that is the distinction to make with Trump's initial voters. Mm-hmm. Before there were a lot of debates, before he really caught on as sort of the front runner, that was the voter. After that, it was just Republicans. And looking at it from Super Tuesday onward, and especially the Arizona primary, looking onward, it wasn't just poorly educated voters and economic distraction voters or distressed economically people. It was 90% of the Republican Party that was just, yeah, he's a winner, let's go for it.
Yep.
And when you look at those voters, you know, a lot of them are doing better now than they were under the Bush administration.
Yeah, a lot better.
You know, a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what they're not doing better at is winning presidential elections.
No.
So, and they want a winner. They want a loudmouth, authoritarian person to win for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what they want. Also, we want to talk a little bit about, I'm going back to my notes now, because I'm a little bit distracted.
It's a big night. This thing that's happening tonight, as we are literally recording this, mm-hmm. as we're doing this, has never happened before.
Yeah.
We want to make that really clear. People who've covered the Congress for decades are just shaking their heads going,
We've never seen a sit-in
in the House.
In the House of Representatives.
During regular order, during the time when they're in session. The Republicans, 4 years ago, did their, you know, drill baby drill bullshit mm-hmm. in an empty House when everybody was on vacation. So good for them. Mm-hmm. What heroes. But this is John Lewis leading an old-style civil rights sit-in.
Mm-hmm.
Of elected representatives, of your elected representatives on the floor of the United States House of Representatives in real time, that is being covered by a phone app called Periscope because they shut the cameras off in the House of Representatives. So C-SPAN is using essentially pirated video, real-time video, that's going out to every station that will cover it. Now, we flipped through the channels a little while ago, and CNN was covering it, and C-SPAN was covering it, and
MSNBC was covering it. Lawrence O'Donnell was covering it.
And Fox News was covering its taped Hannity coverage of Donald Trump's speech and how important
how proud Donald Trump's son is of his dad giving this speech today, reading a teleprompter.
I'm very proud of my daddy. He read that speech real good. He did so good. I'm so proud of him.
What do you think, Sean? Oh, I think it was great.
Oh, it was great. It was great. Money, please.
Pre-recorded Sean Hannity. While the House of Representatives has been taken over and is being broadcast on C-SPAN via cell phones.
Yeah.
Because the cameras are off.
And there is a massive Twitter, Snapchat, social media following. This really is a very, very, very big deal.
Right.
And there is over in the peanut gallery, the GOP who bitch about everything. You know, Paul Ryan tweeted out, this was a stunt. This mm-hmm. is just a stunt.
This is the guy whose party and whose body does Benghazi hearings and endless Obamacare votes.
Right. Repeal
calling,
Obamacare.
Calling what the Democrats are doing tonight about gun violence a stunt.
The entire your party's entire history has been nothing but attempts to overthrow the Obama, shut the government to Obamacare.
Shut down the government.
Shut down the government. 60 fucking votes on taking health care away from people that you knew would never pass. And one witch hunt on Benghazi after another. You are a stunt government. You are a hollow pinata government.
Yep.
And but you know, of course, this doesn't register with Republicans because the part of their brain that can register their own reeking hypocrisy has just been fried out. They don't understand why the Dems are being allowed to do this terrible thing. But it doesn't matter. They're being sort of swamped. And at some point, this is in real time also. Paul Ryan came out to introduce a bill that would essentially overturn the veto of Barack Obama's veto. The net effect of his vote was to make it easier for banks and credit agencies and Wall Street to screw you.
Yep.
And that's what he used as sort of
screw you on your retirement.
Yeah. To make just a little bit easier.
Your retirement investments. Yeah.
And that is what that was the thing that he tried to use as a disruptor, sort of break the rhythm of like, wow, you just doubled down on how much I thought I couldn't feel any more contempt for you, Paul Ryan. I thought I had maxed out, but you did it. You man, you pushed it right over that limit. You took a civil rights protest and jammed in sideways a fuck you, where's my money to your banker funders.
Right.
So you're right. Doubling down. You're getting your check from the NRA and you're getting your check from your banker buddies all in one shot on television. And I get the feeling, I might be wrong, that there were an awful lot of trolls and assholes just off stage who were pushing him onto stage. Like, you're our leader. You get out there and do something about this.
Right.
This is the job you wanted, man. You wanted to be the head of this fascist group of Gomerts.
You wanted to be in a position where you have to please the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah. So congratulations.
And the Freedom Caucus is saying they've got the phone number of my office right on their dais, right on their podium.
Mm-hmm.
You go rip that off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these and I'm sure they're getting phone calls from Democrats in their district,
mm-hmm.
of whom there are some, saying, you know, you should have a vote. And people who have been victims of gun violence in their district, and people who are just finally
mm-hmm.
have their eyes pried open and aren't watching Hannity tonight.
Right.
Saying, you know, let them have a vote because Orlando. Let them have a vote because my nephew's gay.
Mm-hmm.
Let them have a vote because Sandy Hook was a bridge too far. You know, and I do want to insert in here, Drift Glass.
Yeah.
The concern that has been expressed on Twitter and elsewhere about civil liberties.
Yes, a legitimate.
And how a legitimate concern about civil liberties and not just using no-fly lists to prevent people from exercising their rights as citizens and so forth.
Right.
If we had a functioning Congress where I really felt like, oh yeah, you know, once they get a vote, something's going to happen. We're going to get this background check bill and this no-fly list bill, and we're going to ram this no-fly list down people's throats. There will be a big no, big-ass no-fly list with nobody on it will be able to buy a gun.
Right.
And we don't care as long as we can just keep all guns off the street. Whether the no-fly list is good or not, who cares? It's about keeping guns off the street and my values as a non-gun owner being enforced. No, that's not it. This isn't about no-fly lists.
No.
This is about a Congress and a political party that has refused to do anything about anything for 7 years.
Yep.
And there is now an issue where more people are being killed in this country by this thing, by this problem, than by automobile accidents.
Uh-huh.
Getting to that point.
And please go ahead.
As I said in an email to the team over at Crooks and Liars tonight, if as many people that have been killed by gun violence in a year had been killed by a foreign government under a Republican administration, we would have invaded the wrong country already.
Yes, we would have. Absolutely.
Absolutely. So this is not about the details of how do we work out protecting civil liberties while still managing possession of a firearm.
Yes. There is a process for that.
There is a process for that.
It's called politics. It's called the legislative process.
Exactly. It's called having committee hearing meetings, figuring it out,
yep.
meeting with lawyers, meeting with constitutional scholars, really. And that's why you get a 2,000-page bill,
right.
Because you really have to look at it and make sure it's constitutional and make sure that it's going to fit in with protecting the rights of individuals. And as I wrote to one of our listeners today who said, you know, aren't you at all concerned about them sort of just trampling on other amendments to the Constitution besides the second one? And I said, sure, Ted Kennedy was on the no-fly list.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it that the no-fly list is a bad thing and is not properly monitored. They don't have the funding to make it an exact thing. And even if they did, it might be unconstitutional to use it to impinge on somebody's ability to do anything.
Right.
Even fly a plane. I mean, we just don't know. We have not had the legislative branch's involvement in this enough. in a logical way in anything.
We haven't had a healthy debate about any of this.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
No. Can I read you one quote from Charlie Pierce?
Please.
That is absolutely on point here. He says, and I'm quoting my own blog because I'm citing him there. So but this is Charlie Pierce. But at the heart of these actions is more than a protest against inaction on the issue of guns. It is a protest against inaction, period, mm-hmm. against the repulsive and cowardly vandalism by inaction that has been the hallmark of the Congress almost from the second the president's hand came off the Bible in 2009. Mm-hmm. Politicians should vote and then explain their reasons why to the people that elect them. The government should function, period. That's an issue worth fighting over. The issue here really is that. Now, this is my voice now. Making sure the government is destroyed is the Republican Party's goal. Mm-hmm. That it cannot function, that it can get nothing done, that really important issues or trivial issues and everything in between never gets debated honestly, never gets discussed, never gets voted on. If it has Barack Obama's stinky Negro fingers all over it, it will never get passed. It will be filibustered to death because they just hate that guy. They just fucking hate him. And that's the Republican Party. That is their modus operandi. And until the Republican Party is bulldozed to the ground and we piss on its ashes, nothing's going to get done in this country. Nothing. Because that's what they're there for. They're there to destroy our ability to govern ourselves. And that's what this protest is really about.
Yep.
And that's why John Lewis is the perfect person to lead it. Because he makes it so simple. This is simple. This isn't about the details of a particular bill. This is about our right of an American people to have something done about a problem that is killing tens of thousands of Americans every year.
Yep.
Something. All we want you to do is something, and you won't do it. It really – and that's what made – that's why next to Bull Connor is going to be Paul Ryan.
Yep.
Bullshit
yep.
Connor, as I will now start calling him.
And that's what he wants to avoid. I mean, and I thought it was really interesting that Norm Ornstein said that on Lawrence Tonight. Mm-hmm. Said he no, this is really an opportunity for him to be Bull Connor if he plays his cards wrong.
Yep.
And he doesn't want to do that. So he is again between a rock and a hard place, and the hard place is the Freedom Caucus.
Right.
And the rock is John Lewis,
who's
not gonna leave tonight.
who is doing exactly what made successful civil rights protests work. Keep it simple. Have the people out front be respectable, suit and tie wearing Americans, and have them all talk on the issue of fairness and justice, not about a particular detail, an amendment to a particular bill, but the essential unfairness and depravity of what you are doing, how un-American it is to deprive the American people, 90% of whom want this, to even have a fucking vote. And there is no alternate position other than, but the NRA pays me more. And if I vote against this, the fucking lunatics who put me in office will
primary me. Yeah.
And I'm
gonna get primaried. Yeah.
And that's the only argument that Paul Ryan and the rest of his scumbags can make.
Well, and this dovetails back to a couple of things. One is just what I was saying about Republican voters bringing Trump. We have to talk about Trump in all of this too.
We do.
Because
we do.
The Republican voter made Trump the nominee. As Samantha Bee said on Monday night. You know, this is the boll weevil that's gotten into your sofa, and you've got to decide, Republicans. This racist voter is the problem. They are your party, and you got to decide if you need a new party or not. And the amazing thing was Jennifer Rubin also said that.
Oh, my God. Indeed. Jennifer Rubin, who I've described as one of the many neocon throw pillows.
Yeah.
Fred Hite keeps at the op-ed page of the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Jennifer Rubin, who is completely, you know, in the throes of Republican detachment disorder. Those conservatives over there.
The person that has been defending W for 16 years, who says, we need more boots on the ground in Syria. Bibi Netanyahu is a saint.
Yep.
and you know, anybody who wants to talk about voter suppression, that's just sour grapes.
Right.
We won, you lost. You know, that's usually her position, is just she's nuts. And she is always defending the Republican Party.
The worst people in the world.
And the whole Republican Party in the Beltway and in the New York City media, I think, is going through an ice bucket challenge.
Yeah, you said this. This is a great point.
of just, oh, it's Trump, you know, and all of a sudden, whoa, I got to wake up because it's, I can't deny this anymore.
Right.
This is now going to be a absolutely transformative election that will affect my ability to do my job for the rest of my life. It has come home to roost. It is not going to go away, and I have to deal with it.
And you can see everyone from Hugh Hewitt to David Brooks to Michael Gerson desperately trying to construct a narrative in which they are not the villain.
Right.
It's
right.
Somebody else that isn't me that did this.
And I would argue actually that Hugh Hewitt is the exception in that regard because
he's gone.
He is so gleefully looking forward to a Hillary Clinton presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Where he can be the author of The Queen, you know, his book on Hillary Clinton's power-hungry madness. And he's going to buy a second house with all the Hillary Hate Radio Hour that he's planning to do. So,
well, the both-siderists are all looking for a way to recover the both sides narrative that Trump is destroying. And so it's imperative. And if people, I saw Rick Wilson, and I can't remember the name of the woman who was a Ted Cruz zombie on MSNBC several days ago, talking about, and they both hate Donald Trump, and they're both talking about how they can get around him at the convention. But both of them swore on the lives of their children that Donald Trump was not a Republican.
Yeah.
He was some sort of freak. He was a minotaur. He was a sui generis. One of my favorite phrases. He wasn't a Republican. This is not the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Because they have to say that. It is absolutely imperative for the Beltway narrative to survive that Donald Trump be now considered an alien who somehow landed and mind controlled people into voting for him.
And how many votes did Donald Trump get? How many delegates did he win in the Republican primary?
He won more votes than anybody ever. And
in the Republican primary. That's right.
And all the delegates he needs and then some. He can wipe his ass with, you know, all the leftovers.
I think he has 300 delegates to spare.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the Republican.
He won. And so in a moment of absolute existential meltdown, Jennifer Rubin wrote in the Washington Post, "One therefore is left with an unpleasant reality. A plural of GOP voters wanted Trump. They didn't care or may have actively embraced his lunacy, bigotry, and ignorance." A Republican wag joked that the GOP not only needs a new candidate, but a new base. There is something to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what?
And I think this is, as I said about I made the analogy of the ice bucket challenge. Uh-huh. This is going to last with Jennifer Rubin until her hair dries.
Exactly. And then we go back.
And once Trump loses.
Yeah.
We're going to go right back to Hillary Clinton's destroying America, these liberals, blah, blah, blah. And it's going to depend on how I think the Republican Party as an institution recovers from Trump. I don't think it's too early to talk about that.
No.
And whether it does, I have suggested to you all week that I think Mitt Romney should become the RNC chair.
Yeah,
if I'm being benevolent here and saying, no, let's save the two-party system from itself and put someone in charge, let him save the Olympics again. You know, let him come in. He's been against Trump from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. He's got street cred in that regard and he knows how to raise money.
Right.
And if he has the energy for it, and he's boring, he's fucking boring, which is what you want. You want a fucking boring manager who can raise money.
Right. He's a Chamber of Commerce guy.
Yeah. And he would be, if I was a Republican establishment type in any area of power, he'd be the one I'd pick.
Yep.
To be the next RNC chair. Please get us through the next congressional election.
Yes,
you know,
without
and recover all of the money from these donors who because the problem is not the billionaire donors who give, you know, $1.2 million checks to candidates. It's the $100,000 donors who are, you know, the bread and butter that Reince Priebus supposedly brings to the party.
Yeah.
And who can fund things like conventions who have shut their checkbooks.
Yep.
And that's bad. It's really bad.
And speaking of responsible people who are responsible for things, we are entering a moment I don't know what's going to happen in the next 6 months. I dare not predict anything. I have my own beliefs about who's going to win and how badly Donald Trump is going to get his ass kicked. But that's just me. I'm not privy to those conversations. But what I will say is this. Right after the wheels came off of the Bush administration, around 2005, 2006, there was a moment. Right after Barack Obama kicked Republicans' ass around the block twice, especially in 2008, 2009, there was a moment. There is coming.
Well, there was a moment there because the economy had fallen apart, too.
But there was a moment when the essential depravity and falsehood of the Beltway narrative was laid bare. When there was no place for them to hide. Before they could regroup and they could, you know, bring the waters of forgetfulness back over everyone. We could get back to pretending liberals are bad.
And both sides.
And there was a moment when the Bush administration just fucking blew it completely. I mean, they lost New Orleans. Terry Schiavo was a thing. There was Abu Ghraib. The wheels came off in Iraq. There was no WMD. Oh, my God. All the shit liberals were saying. And by God, now we have deficits again.
And Dick Cheney had a tax return with $23 million profit from the war.
Blood money. And there was a moment.
In 1 year.
When even David Gregory, with all of his mighty simian beltway power, could not keep that narrative off the air.
He had to have Marcos Melitzis on his show.
After the Obama people kicked their ass in 2009, there was a moment when it was clear the people of America, the voters, had given this president a mandate. And in each case, there was the Beltway media, and I blame them completely for this. The Republican Party is going to do what it's going to do, but their Beltway enablers, the media enablers, were allowed to go back to pretending that the racist heart of the Republican Party did not exist.
Right.
And that the Bush administration had never happened. They were helped a lot by a bunch of Democrats, including Barack Obama, who said, let's look forward, not back. Nancy Pelosi said, let's take impeachment off the table.
Right.
No, let's not. Let's put it right back on the table. So there was plenty of blame to go around. But we are going to reach another moment when the Republican Party is so laid out in the sun that its rotting corpse can't be. There's not enough Vicks VapoRub that you can put in the world, put under your nose to hide the stink of the rotting corpse of the Republican Party. And it is, you're going to watch the Beltway media, print, radio, television, et cetera, desperately trying to find a way to bury that body and pretend it didn't happen. And it's going to be up to liberals. This time out, it's going to be up to liberals to make Chuck Todd's life miserable. Phone calls, letters, emails, texts. He's got to go out for coffee sometime. Spit in his coffee if you get a chance. And make Phil Griffin's life a misery. Make Andy Lack's life really unpleasant. Find out their contact information, their email information, their business address. Never bother people at home like this. And when they start to close that up and bury it like they will, it is up to liberals. This time out, it'll be up to liberals. Make the collaborators and conspirators miserable. And that's what John Luce is doing right now on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. He is saying, no. We're not going to play this game anymore. We're not going to have moments of silence anymore. You can shove us off here. You can close this place down and bring the cops in and move us. But then that will be the picture. That is your political legacy. And you have to make these people suffer. You have to make David Brooks shit blood. You know, you have to.
Well, and part of it is, let me go back to that, to the fact that it's John Lewis doing this. And also the fact that the victims of Orlando were gay. And that the gay community has not allowed the bullshit meme that it wasn't about being gay to stand. They have not. They have made this up. They have made Orlando in particular about gay victimization and how they were targeted because they were gay. And to pretend that that's not true, as every Republican on Twitter did, every Republican elected official on Twitter did. And what I really appreciate about that is that just like John Lewis, the gay community has really made their issues about human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, and as you said, about fairness and about equality and not about, I'm going to be allowed to let my freak flag fly mm-hmm. because freakitude is great.
No, or they figured out that it's about, I want to be able to enjoy the same rights you enjoy.
Yeah. And it's the old Martin Luther King argument of the Constitution says I have these rights as a citizen. Therefore, you, powerful white America or powerful straight America or powerful Republican Party in the Congress, mm-hmm. need to live up to the ideals of the document that you have said runs this country. And the power of that is tangible.
Yeah.
I also wanted to just interject a little bit about how terrified the dead enders are.
Yeah.
In the media.
Yeah.
And not the the red state writers who are all anti-Trump, because there is a real split in the conservative movement now.
Right down to the bone. Yeah.
It is. I mean, at Crooks and Liars, I linked Red State this week.
I know.
Because, first of all, they hate Trump with fiery, hot passion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to read that.
Yes.
From a conservative perspective, it's hilarious. It's like, really? You voted for Bush twice.
Yeah, yeah.
You voted for McCain. McCain and Romney were fine with you, but this is a bridge too far. Mr. 47%, you could swallow that. But this, because he's crude.
Right.
And he hasn't etch-a-sketched enough for you.
Right.
He's not going to represent you as a conservative. And so, but the people who have said, oh, well, I'm going to support but not endorse.
Right.
And you call that splunging.
Splunge. It's
which is a great Monty Python word, right?
Uh-huh.
And if you get a chance, go to Driftglass blog and scroll down to where he's got the splunge video of splunge means you're a yes man. And when your boss pushes you into a corner and you have to say, I agree, but I also have original ideas and I'm not just a yes man, you say splunge.
It might be a great idea, but maybe not. And I'm not being indecisive. Splunge. Yeah.
I wanted to go back to something that Nicole Wallace, formerly of the McCain campaign.
I know.
Said at the beginning of this month, you know, our voters identified the right problem was that the establishment is out of touch with the base of the party about economics.
Uh-huh.
But our base has not become fundamentally racist. Come on.
You're right. They didn't become that way. You bought them off the shelf that way.
Were you even awake during the McCain campaign when people walked into the rallies saying, you know, Obama's a Kenyan?
Yeah.
And you have said the symbol of this whole thing, of this whole splunging, is a poster of Obama with a bone through his nose.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Here, this is your party.
This is
the people you voted for in 2008 and 2012. And now Trump's gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
No, he hasn't.
Do you remember?
He is your party.
Do you remember a Saturday Night Live sketch with Tom Hanks? I think it was Tom Hanks. Mr. Short-Term Memory Guy.
Oh, yeah. Short-Term Memory.
Who's you know, who can't remember anything 5 minutes later. And he's on a date going, and he's ordering, and then he orders again, and then he orders again. And the woman across from him, he's like, hey, who are you? But there's a moment there where he starts to eat. He goes, what's this food doing in my mouth? That's the level of denial people like Nicole Wallace walk through every day. Look, that big diseased dick in your mouth, put it there. You put it there. And pretending you didn't makes you look like a stupid liar.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the people around the table, I know that your good close personal friend Michael Steele, I know your good close personal friend Joe Scarborough, I know all the other scumbags you hang out with are never going to laugh at you to your face, but that's the peril that you share with the rest of the conservatives, is that you only talk to each other. You only lie to each other. You circle jerk each other with these ludicrous fantasies that, you know what'll work? We'll pretend we didn't realize the party was full of racists. Yeah, that's a good idea. What do you think, Michael Steele? Oh, yeah, that's an excellent idea. And the rest of us are out here going, oh, my God, That's the best you've got? That's literally all you've got is let's pretend it never happened. Well, you know, that worked once after Iraq, and that worked again when Barack Obama was elected. But this time out of the box, it's our job on the left to make sure these people are miserable, are made professionally miserable every time they pull this shit. It's time I saw a lot of this stuff going around about maybe tonight is finally the death of the both sides do it meme. I don't believe that for a minute. I believe it could be if you take
I actually got a reply from Norm Ornstein about that because I thought that Trump banning the Washington Post from covering his campaign, you know, was going to do it, was going to turn it off. And all of a sudden, oh, well, we can't say both sides anymore because Hillary Clinton's never said the Washington Post can't cover her campaign and limited it to Breitbart.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he replied and said, you know, you would think that would happen, but this both-siderism is really powerful stuff.
It is.
It's a powerful drug. So, we'll see.
We will see. I mean, that's why we have a podcast.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
part of our job in a weird way, this is audible, but also on our blogs and Crooks and Liars, is to document this stuff. I can go back 10 years and see what I wrote, what I said, what was in the paper. What the issues were. It's you know, one of the things I did mention today is that for all of our frustrations, future historians owe the conservative movement a huge thank you because they have eagerly and exhaustively self-documented their own paranoia and racism and mind-boggling stupidity in microscopic detail. Every fucking day, they're willing to say, yes, we really are this racist. Yes, we are this lying sack of shit. And while now it's incredibly frustrating, 20 years from now, they're going to be looking back at Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Breitbart and Red State and Hugh Hewitt the same way that we look back on the Klan. My God, you rode around with sheaths on burning crosses on people's lawns. How did you not think that history would look bad at you, would look down at you? Well, the answer is we thought we would control history. We thought we'd never lose. And there'd be no one to judge us.
We had a permanent Republican majority,
we're
going to
have
a
permanent majority. So no one's ever going to hold us accountable for this. So we can do whatever the fuck we want. Well, they have. And again, it's a long – history is a very long time. But decades from now, it will be very, very unpleasant – to have been a conservative in 2016 and be asked.
Yeah.
Of course, by that time, they're going to lie through their, oh, no, I love Barack Obama. I thought he was the greatest president ever.
He was
awesome.
A good president. You know, he wasn't a bad president. Compared to Hillary, he was great.
But Grandpa, here's your blog. That wasn't me. Yeah, no, it was.
We want to do one more thing, I think.
Yep.
Sonia Sotomayor.
Oh, that wasn't my thing, but go ahead.
Proved the importance of representation.
Yeah.
By saying, oh, no, you know, this stopping an illegal searching while black thing isn't just a one-off. She referred to W.E.B. Du Bois and Ta-Nehisi Coates and the book on the new Jim Crow and on and on. Oh, and the FBI report on Ferguson.
Yeah.
The Ferguson Police Department, all in her dissent of no, really. The police can't make up an excuse after an illegal search as to why they were allowed to search you because that's bullshit. And it's beautifully written. It's well worth reading. There are links to it out there. You can actually probably just at this point search Sotomayor on Twitter and find it. Really worth reading and looking at. And the importance of a Democratic president is if you want more Sonia Sotomayors on the court. You got to have a Democrat to do it.
Yeah. And if you want more Antonin Scalia's, or worse, appointed by Donald Trump, by all means, stay home in November. It's really that clear. I mean, you know, there's a lot of wrangling and arguing that has to be done inside the family. There are a lot of deeply problematic things about the Democratic Party that I would like to see fixed. But right now, that is the only bulwark we have against a staggeringly horrifying, much worse.
Yep.
My one more thing was, don't go see The Lobster.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Lord. We went to see The Lobster which is this art film, which maybe you've heard of it, maybe you've seen ads for it. It is an independent film made by a foreign director whose name I don't have on me right now. It is about coupling in a very odd society where people are forced to be paired up, and if you do not find a partner in this particular hotel within 45 days, you are turned into an animal. Mm-hmm. And our lead character wants to be turned into a lobster. That's why it's called The Lobster. So it sounds quirky. It sounds, yeah. It's got this hotel, so it's got the Wes Anderson feel to it. Yeah. From the ads, we thought that's what it was going to be.
Yeah.
The reviews from professional reviewers were good.
Yep.
It has a stellar cast of people.
Yep.
John C. Reilly is in it. Mm-hmm. He's very funny, usually. Rachel Weisz is the female lead. And the male lead is Colin Farrell. And, you know, it's Yorgos. I've got it up now. Yorgos Lanthimos, mm-hmm. Who is apparently a darling of
Great, for him. That's wonderful.
And so it actually was nominated, turns out, for a BAFTA award and an Australian Film Critics Association award and a British Independent Film Award. It actually won for Best Actor and Best Director. Oh, no, excuse me. It won for Best Supporting Actress for Olivia Colman, who is a great actress. She was great in The Night Manager. She's such a good actress.
Yeah, she is.
I do love her, yep. And I think she probably got that British Independent Film Awards because everybody saw her in Night Manager and loved her for that.
And she plays she's a good actress. They're all good actors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This movie also won a jury prize from the Cannes Film Festival. So, I mean, we thought going to this that we would like it and, you know, that at least we would be entertained.
And I don't have the music box here as I did in Chicago or a bunch of art house films. So when an art film comes to Central Illinois, yeah, we'll go see it. Sure.
It was playing. We had a matinee. We went to a matinee to see it. And oh my God.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, it was really bad. Really.
This movie contained, I won't spoil it if you really want to go see it, but except to say, please don't.
Yeah.
It had a torture scene. Mm-hmm. It had, the murder of an animal,
uh-huh.
A domesticated animal, an actual bloody murder, uh-huh. of a domesticated animal. You saw the dead, bloody animal on screen for quite a while,
mm-hmm.
Who had been violently murdered,
mm-hmm.
In a torturous way. And it had self-mutilation by several characters in several different ways.
Yes.
And it was supposed to be a comedy. And I never figured out in this movie why.
Yeah. Well,
so
and it's clear that to me, to my untrained mm-hmm. cinematic eye,
mm-hmm.
That it wanted to be somewhere between Franz Kafka mm-hmm. and Brazil.
And Terry Gilliam. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Holy crap. It landed on some completely different planet.
Yeah.
It was the acting was deliberately flat and
yep,
and
on purpose.
Flat yep. affect. Every single character was written. I think I mentioned going out of the theater. Oh, this is what a Wes Anderson script would sound like if it was written by Wes Anderson when he was seven and he was a sociopath. Because it was, I am going to shave my face now. Now I'm shaving yes. my face. My face is now mm-hmm. shaved. I will now go down and sit. And you know what? There is a place for that in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But there's
also an opportunity in some respects. If the characters are all doing that and you know why they're doing
yes.
it, that could be hilarious.
It could be. Or ominous. Or it could be a lot of
yeah.
things. The one thing it wasn't in any way was entertaining or engaging.
Right.
And part of me thought, you know what? Maybe this is a genius movie. Because maybe the whole movie is about unbearably oppressive relationships that you are forced into.
Right.
And
right.
maybe the movie is an unbearably oppressive relationship
that you're being forced into.
And you are sitting through this thing praying for it to get better. And it mm-hmm. never does.
And it never, just like your relationship,
and like,
it never
holy
does.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
This was a complete disappointment and waste of time. And I'm sure we will hear from all the people who want to tell us we didn't get it, man. You didn't understand it.
Well, and I can see how a subset of highly urbanized people who feel cut off from normal relationships.
Yes.
Due to the fact that housing is just out of reach for two people.
Yeah.
And you're obsessed with your job, and that your the whole of your society demands that you stay together with one person.
Or you find someone.
And at the same time, yeah. And find someone, and at the same time forbids you.
Yeah.
And I, you know, both of those sides of that argument are in this film, but it's so torturous how they go about being that way that, I mean, yes, you get, yes, there is a sledgehammer that says there are these two worlds side by side, mm-hmm. but it's not entertaining. It's gut wrenching. And I actually said, I didn't realize it was near the end of the movie, but I said to you, if what happens, what I think is going to happen, happens in this movie, you and I are walking out.
Yeah.
And then the movie just ends before that thing happens.
Yes. Roll credits.
I'm like, the end. And I was like, oh, they're not even going to tell you
right.
if the bad thing happened or not. They're just going to leave it open.
And I might be missing the profound symbolic weight and importance of various things that are alien to me. that I don't understand culturally, that might this particular shot of a forest and people in it might have tremendous cultural significance. I just don't understand. I'm willing to accept that. But if you want to understand, if David Brooks is looking for the point at which the disconnect between the elite and the hoi polloi happens, come see people leaving this movie. Because they all went in holding their reviews from A.O. Scott and the New York Times.
Yeah, New Yorker
like,
magazine.
Oh my God, this is an awesome movie. And they all and the people who came out looked at each other like, holy fuck, what the hell was that?
What?
And why did I pay for it?
And then I went home and read the user reviews at Fandango, and it's like, there is such a disconnect.
Yeah.
So we have talked far too long about this movie.
We have. But beware.
But thank you, Driftglass. Yeah, don't go see that movie.
No.
But shorter Driftglass and Blue Gal, don't go see the lobster. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week we're doing something a little different. We got an email from one of our podcast listeners named Justin. And Justin wrote to us and said, hello from Iowa. I am a faithful listener from the cornfields of Iowa. I want to thank you for putting to words the problems and concerns I have with the Republican political machine. Driftglass is correct in saying we Democrats need to save the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I am going to be in Springfield to sell some sheep at a show and sale at the Illinois State Fairgrounds. My dad and I are probably the most liberally progressive people in the entire sheep industry.
And they were.
If you would like to stop by and talk politics, we would love to chat with you. After listening to you talk about sheep on the trail end of your last podcast, we figure you should come and see a couple. Lattes on me. Signed, Justin. Enclosed is a picture of my youngest son and some lambs. It's not an internet kitty, but it's still cute. Oh, my gosh. Of course, they're so cute.
Uh-huh.
And we went to the fairgrounds, which is an easy drive for us.
Uh-huh.
And saw Justin and his dad and oh my God.
Uh-huh. Oh my God.
First of all, the sheep are, these are show sheep. Okay.
Yeah.
These are like the Cheviot Society. These sheep are in perfect condition.
Yep.
They are there to show. They are there for breeding.
They're pampered
They're pampered more than my mother's cats.
Yeah.
That's how pampered they are. They're all of them are hand shorn, with beautiful coiffures on their head. The wool is kept longer on their heads. They are fed new mown hay. They have beautiful water buckets in their pens. Each sheep at this entire show, not just Justin's sheep, but each sheep has posted above their pen the genealogy of the sheep back six generations, back to great great grandparents.
Uh-huh.
I said, I can't believe you've got this genealogy. He said, oh, I can go back 10 generations. I can go back 15 generations. And one of the reasons is they're trying to breed out mad cow disease from sheep. And so they actually do a lot of genetic testing on these sheep.
Yeah, which is called scrapie, I think, in sheep.
Yeah, scrapie in sheep. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's a science, and each sheep has an identifiable number in a, I suppose an international, but certainly a national database of sheep. And they're sheep.
They're sheep. And my lovely wife, who is a knitting fanatic, you might realize this. You might know from
you might know
got
this
to visit the factory floor.
I did. I got to see the sheep, and they are, you know, I got to talk to them, and got to pet one of them. Mm-hmm. And but even more than that, I got to watch my husband talk with Justin's dad, who is the most foul-mouthed, brilliant Irishman. I mean, it was really back to your home country with this guy, right?
I mean, he might have had.
And he was a former principal, right, or educator.
Was a former principal, and my dad was a principal also.
Yeah, and this guy didn't talk about Republicans. He talked about fucking Republicans.
To be fair, he might have had a beer or two. It was a hot day, you know, cooling down.
It was a hot day.
But it was, and I swear to you, as far as I can tell, we were the only people in this very large building that were talking.
The sheep barn. The sheep barn. The sheep barn.
Which is next to the goat barn.
At the Illinois County Fairgrounds. In Sangamon County, Springfield, Illinois. We mean it when we say we live down the street from a corn.
We do.
This is farm country.
This is absolutely farm country. This was a big deal. This show was a very big deal.
This was a big deal. There were probably 150 farms there.
From all over the country. And they were top-notch, hand-raised, pampered livestock who were there for their wool, who were there for their lineage and their
lineage and breeding, and so that you would buy one of these sheep to breed with your sheep because they're so perfect to bring about, you know, wool producers that or lamb producers, whatever it is that you're farming sheep for. But if mutton, whatever, whether it's meat or wool, you're doing it because these are top of the line genetically bred creatures that you have brought to sell, and they're perfect.
And it's a family business. I mean, there were three generations there.
And the kids were there. Yeah. Grandpa was there. Yeah. Dad was Justin. And then the five-year-old was just adorable. He was all over the place. And there was an older boy, too. And they both had their summer mohawks. Uh-huh. And it was really, it was a lot of fun.
But I guarantee you, we were the only two people talking very volubly among all these other farmers about the fucking Republicans.
And
oh, my God, can you believe? It was quite rewarding. And we had a blast. We had a really fun time. This happens.
We're going to go next year. Yeah. He's already invited us, and we're going to go next year. And
this has happened a few times. This is not, we're not in the backwoods. This is a crossroads of Route 66 and I-55, 57. People do come in from out of town a lot to visit or to go to a trade show like this or just on their way someplace else. And so we have had coffee and sit downs with a few podcast listeners.
And you're very welcome to reach out to us and just email us at proleftpodcast@gmail.com if you're going to be in town. We will try to make it happen. Uh-huh. And I think you particularly had a blast with Justin and his dad. I was really in nirvana walking around talking to the sheep.
Oh, yeah.
There was no doubt about why I was there.
I get the feeling on the Iowa farm country, Justin's dad doesn't get a lot of time to talk to fellow travelers, let's say.
Yeah.
And so when one comes along, he really wants to tell you another story.
Well, it's great.
It is. It's
and
wonderful.
That's awesome because we feel the same way. And that's one reason we podcast. Absolutely. So,
So we had a blast. Thank you for inviting us. And our internet kitty this week is all of their sheep.
Justin's sheep. Justin's lamb. And you know, by the way, not coincidentally, Dog-Faced Herman from our Science Fiction University also has beautiful sheep and has sent us videos and his little, but they grow so fast. You know, there's these gorgeous little lambs peeking out from the barn, and then he sends me a picture 2 weeks later. I was like, what happened? They ate and ate and ate and ate and ate.
Now they're surly teenagers.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But thank you, Justin, for inviting us. We look forward to seeing you next year at the fairgrounds. And, it was a blast. We had a great time.
And you can send us your internet kitty or sheep.
You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, or you can tell us you're going to be in town at proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, go Postal Unions, letter on the air unless you say otherwise. It's probably high time, Driftglass, that we also let people know and remind people that we're going to be at Netroots Nation in St. Louis this
year. Absolutely. In less than a month.
So if that is something that you're going to be doing, also please write us and tell us, because we will be over at, for a good part of probably Saturday afternoon, we will be at the Netroots radio booth, broadcasting and talking and meeting with people. And that's probably the best place where they'll have an open space where we can meet as many of our listeners as are there. So please come by and say hello.
I'll be in a tuxedo.
No,
because
yeah,
what
I'll
are
be
we?
In a ball gown.
Because what are we, farmers?
Oh, wait.
Actually,
we were honorary farmers last week.
We were.
Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And again, we thank you so much for remembering our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local, but we also benefit from you shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box store. Mm-hmm. And someone did write to us this week and said, you know, it's not too early. I hate to tell you this. It's not too early for me to start buying school supplies.
Oh, yeah.
For my three kids who've been driving me crazy. I said, yeah, you know, I know what that's like.
Yeah.
You know, you see something on sale, you see something that's reduced. And I've already purchased the planners for the kids for next year, the calendars. So it is not too soon. And those calendars that start in August are out, and you know, so we got them, and Amazon has good prices on that sort of stuff sometimes. So it's worth shopping around, and if you can buy at a local outlet, but if you're going to go to Target, you know, or Walgreens to get your school supplies, shop Amazon. You'll be giving to the Professional Left Podcast.
Yeah, baby.
Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. Is it really midnight?
It is. It is. It's tomorrow.
It's, by the way, it's midnight.
It's tomorrow.
See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. Hey, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, you know, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties would like to note that Paul Ryan always blocks coverage of their sit-ins, too.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Let's think about loving.
Think about loving.
Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow and the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome! Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, we are reading your submissions on the topic of vacation in space. This week, both stories that we're reading are about vacations in space. Oh, excuse me. I'm so sorry. That is not true. Mark's story actually is about wedding in space. Remember?
Yes.
We read this out loud. That's right. It takes a while to get there, but it is about wedding in space. I forgot.
And in my best Groucho voice, and a wedding ain't no vacation.
And a wedding ain't no vacation. All right. So I'm going to read Mark's story.
Okay.
The title of his wedding in space story is Terms of Surrender.
Terms of Surrender. A softcore space pornography.
No, we're not going to do that. Because
oh, I'm sorry. You're right. A hardcore space pornography by Mark.
We have respect for the writer here.
We do.
But I do think, I'm sorry, I laughed because Terms of Surrender on a marriage story is pretty funny. But I hadn't. I had lost the sense of irony about that until we're reading this for the second time. I apologize, yeah. Mark. All right, we're starting again and being serious about it this time.
Absolutely, okay.
Mark's wedding in space story is called Terms of Surrender, and here it is. Nestor's ship decelerated as it entered orbit around Timara. Nestor looked down at the planet through his window. The green of vegetation surrounded by the blue of the oceans was stained with the dark gray of cities, reduced to smoldering craters by his planet's weaponry. As they came around to the dark side of Timara, He saw the battlecruiser Sethora in orbit above Tamara's capital, the last major city not decimated by their weapons. Nestor's ship docked with the Sethora, and he passed through the levels of security he helped devise and install. Retinal scan, voice recognition, genetic analysis. No one stepped on the Sethora without authorization, and security monitors knew the identity of every life form on board. Nestor walked through the passages to reach the observation deck, which featured a grand view of the planet below. An altar was erected at the center point of the panoramic window, with rows of seating to accommodate hundreds of dignitaries from both the defeated Tamarans and the victorious Akaroans. Akaroa was colonized more than 300 years earlier by Tamara. They sent their poor and working people to the new planet with the promise of a new start and a new life. In reality, it was their solution for the ongoing strife between the affluent and the impoverished. Over the decades of colonization, the Akaroans overcame the hardships of taming an alien planet and created a world of their own. The challenges of a biologically diverse but threatening world created an Akaroa built on a foundation of survival and warrior strength. Out of this crucible arose Solda Vanyan, who convinced Akaroa that their own planet was not reward enough. They should go back to Tamara and claim their ancestral world, which they did. The Tamarans, content and complacent in their luxury, were unprepared for the savagery of Vanyan and the Akaroans. Left with no choice but to yield or watch more cities be destroyed, Tamara surrendered. As terms of peace, Vanyan is marrying his son to Anya, the daughter of Tamara's prime counselor. After the marriage is affirmed, Solda Vanyan will rule both planets. As far as the rest of his men could tell, Nestor was going over every last detail of security to ensure that nothing unexpected happened. Satisfied that everything was in place, he went to his private office in another part of the ship. Once inside, he used his thumbprint to open the front panel of what appeared to be a network server. Instead of wires and processors, however, the panel revealed a miniature fusion device, similar to the immense drives that powered the ship, and hence undetectable to radiation and energy monitors. He planned to activate it before the wedding and detonate it before Anya reached the altar. His personal communication device, the one that he made sure was not monitored by his own military, beeped, and he entered a complex code to activate it. An image of Anya came up on the small screen. "Is everything ready?" she asked. "Yes," Nestor replied. "Good," Anya said. "I love you, Nestor." "I love you too," he said. And the image went dark.
Well, well.
All right. So this is an arranged marriage.
Yep.
Between warring planets. One planet was colonized by another to get rid of their poor people. Uh-huh. And then the poor people became warriors and attacked the home planet and took it over. And now there's going to be a marriage between the warlord of the colonized planet and the princess daughter of the Kardashian, if you will,
yes,
of the home planet, the luxurious home planet. And I take it that Nestor is her father. And
that makes sense.
And he's going to destroy the planet. He's going to destroy everything before the marriage can take place.
Well,
or
that's
something. Blow up the wedding, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Is he going to destroy his daughter?
Mm-hmm.
Is he gonna? You know, is he gonna kill his daughter?
Yeah, yeah. It looks like it.
It does. There are elements here. I mean, you could call her Deja Thoris if you'd like, the Bride of Mars.
Yeah,
a princess of Mars. Not to say that that's illegitimate in any way.
It has. First of all, I think there is the plot elements of the story are really good. I like Wedding in Space. You've fit that to a T. There's danger involved. There's conflict. We know who everybody is. We know what they stand for. All of that is there, and that's awesome. So, you know, no complaints about that. You had some comments about
Just some stuff. There's an awful lot of narrative. I mean, again, this is only two pages, so
right. This is like four paragraphs and a little bit of dialogue. That's it. Yeah. Right.
The first three paragraphs are probably a running start at the actual story. That once you've nailed down what everything looks like and where everything is and how everything works, you can take those and work them into the body of the story later.
Right. I think the part I like when we read this the first time that you said was, you can take these paragraphs are your notes for what the story is, and you have to write them down as an author and as a writer. You have to know all of this about your story, but then you take that and you sort of set it aside and you incorporate it into walking and talking yes. and walking.
Exactly. I could recommend a couple of books to read because this has a sort of Australian prison colony feel to it. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein. Okay. Frank Herbert has the Dosidai experiment, where a planet that was designated as a hostile environment to contain people has made those people very strong. So strong that they are now a danger to the people who imprisoned them.
Mm-hmm.
So just for sort of background information about how other writers have handled this kind of situation.
Well, that is also Mad Max. I mean, to a certain extent, it is. But you said Australian, then that's what made me think Mad Max.
The outback, the idea of a prison colony. The Botany Bay.
Yep.
You've put these people out into a hostile environment because you don't give a shit about them, and now they've come back to haunt you. One thing to consider, just as a thought experiment, this isn't in any way attempting to change the story. But just as a matter of mechanical reality, putting things in space costs a lot of money. Anywhere, in any physical universe, putting things into orbit, especially when you have fusion engines and things like that, even if you have fusion engines, is an incredibly expensive proposition. So putting your entire population of the poor and destitute on another planet must have been an enormously expensive undertaking. So, just as a thought experiment, I was wondering what would happen if the wealthy people left the planet. We've used it all up. It's a shithole now. There's this paradise that's far away, but it's really expensive to get there. So we're leaving y'all behind and taking all the good shit with us. Bye. It has the same tension that you have. And you've also left behind a population that is going to be weeded out by weakness over the next
they're going to be survivors. Exactly.
They're going to be really pissed that you did this to them.
Yep.
So,
and you are also, by the very nature of leaving, you are going to have to leave behind technology that will make them eventually capable of following you.
Yeah.
It may take several generations, but you're leaving enough technology behind that it's completely believable that eventually the poor people would figure out how to do what you did.
Yeah. But so, there's a long history of this kind of story. The Fremen in Dune were the oppressed people who became strong through their oppression. The Sarduakar, I believe it's pronounced, in Dune, were the warriors on the side of the Empire, who were fierce because they were, raised as Spartans, basically. They were, killed if they didn't make the cut. So the whole idea of an uprising among the colony that you thought you had cast out or left behind or were beneath you and are now literally above you with their guns trained on your city, there's an inherent drama there. And the idea that you can have a wedding. So, the writer in me says, the first three paragraphs should be for you now to internalize and to parse out during the walking and talking portion of the story to come. But keep up the good work. It's a nice plot, well done.
Like I said, the characters are it's so clear, A, who your audience is, B, who the characters are, and C, what they want.
And there's one word that didn't take me out of the story, but made me wonder about the author's intent, which was every life form on board.
Yeah.
Are there more than one species in this thing?
That's stuck with me too.
Yeah. And that's not a bad thing. But if there are only people in this world, then every person on board is the word you probably want. If you want to tease us that, there are orcs and there are Ewoks and there are other species involved, then that's a good word. So just make sure that that's your intention. That's all. Nicely done. Keep up the good work.
We are going to do another story. This is by Peter.
Hello, Peter.
This is the title, at least the words at the top of the page are Summer Vacation in Space. So, Summer Vacation in Space. And Drift Class, you're going to read this one.
I am. And the word vacation is in quotes.
Quotes.
Okay. So, yes. And before we go in, I would advise Peter, capitalized letters are your friend.
This story, by the way, is sort of written in E.E. Cummings text. It is mm-hmm. almost all in lowercase.
Yep.
I'm assuming he typed it on his phone. Yep. And it looks like there are periods, but it's hard to sort of read this out loud because it's all in lowercase. So. Right.
And there are reasons why you break a paragraph at the point when dialogue begins and ends.
Mm-hmm.
To set it off. And that isn't happening here. So that's just technical. But I thought they'd get out of the way to explain away the various screw-ups that may occur as I read
it. As he's reading it.
Yeah. So, it's not me, man.
I know.
But again, those are just technical things.
You are really cushioning the blame here.
We are. But those are easy to fix.
Yeah.
All right. Ready?
Yeah.
Summer Vacation in Space by Peter. She giggled as she bounced off the rubberized bulkheads. Papa, she squeaked. Look at me. He was looking at her. Look what I can do. She was like a ballerina in microgravity. The ballet and gymnastics classes paid off on that dead rock below. She spun in space, gracefully dancing off the walls of the capsule, while most of the other adults and children were vomiting into their space sickness bags. They, however, enjoyed the microgravity. It was like all the scuba trips they went on. He was floating peacefully in a welcome environment, and she was exploring the limits of her abilities. Taking bonine also helped. Motion sickness is a bitch. After a graceful spin from the port bulkhead, she crouched into a superhero landing and prepared to launch herself into her papa's arms. Oh, shit, he thought, as he noticed that she was going to launch herself as fast as possible at him. He prepared for a ballistic five-year-old to knock him into the aft bulkhead. He crouched into a squat and aimed at her. Just a gentle push should counteract her momentum. There might be a boo-boo or two, but he felt his mass would absorb most of her kinetic energy and protect his precious missile. It's a good thing that kids are made of rubber these days, he thought, as he caught his precious ballistic five-year-old and crashed into the starboard bulkhead, barely missing the vomiting parent of another vacationer. He knew there would be several bruises visible on his body when he took off his suit at the Lagrangian station. Papa, L asked. Yes, Papa responded, coughing from the pain in his back from the impact. Are we there yet? Papa laughed, coughing some more blood, remembering long trips on Earth when his family, instead of focusing on the injuries, trying to hide his pain from her. He attached the clips to their suits as the acceleration lights came on and bathed the capsule in red. He held her tightly. Sweetheart, we are close. We have traveled around the world 3 times, and we'll get to the station soon. We need a slingshot to the Lagrangian point. 1.5 million kilometers is a long way away. She cocked her head to the right. Are we going to Mars? Papa laughed. Not yet. Papa, she inquired. She was such a curious little girl. She started to sing. Mars is fourth and it is red, they sang. It might once have life, but now is probably dead. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. Science tells us what you are. Papa said, we'll bring it back to life, all of it. But for now, let's enjoy our vacation in space. Approaching destination, the speakers announced. The almost lifelike voices were getting better at sounding human. Elle and Papa looked out of the forward display and beheld the station now coming into view. The computer encircled the dot in red as it was growing in size. Fast. Papa? Yes, sweetheart. She was worried. They were not slowing down. Are we going to crash and die? Papa laughed. No, sweetheart, he said calmly. The docking web will absorb all of our kinetic energy and help to power the station and slow us down. She looked at him as if to figure out if he was telling the truth. She decided that he was. Okay, Papa, I love you. She hugged him as best she could from her tethered position. I love you too, little miss. Hold on. They entered the docking web and their capsule shuddered and screamed, but it was only for a moment. They were stationary in microgravity at the center of the station, the slight gravity from their acceleration gone. The circular Lagrangian station spun around them.
its web connecting all parts, serving the purpose of capturing their ship as well. We're here, Papa Sung. I'm so excited, El Squeed. And now we can have your vacation while I work. He said, knowing that his most precious person was safe from what would happen next. The end.
All right. There's a lot I like about this story. First of all, everyone can identify with a little girl who's traveling with her dad and is a little bit out of control.
Yes, that is absolutely the strength of this story.
And you have nailed that. I mean, you have just nailed what that feels like. Mm-hmm. I would like to see this story written in first person from the position of the father.
Yeah.
I think it would be stronger if you sort of just told the story from my daughter. She's ballerina. She's got out of the seat. She started dancing around. Papa, Papa, Papa. We sang the song that we always sing.
Mm-hmm.
About
holy
Mars
crap!
Twinkle,
she's about
twinkle.
To jump across the capsule.
Oh God! Here she comes. I have to make sure I don't crush my rib cage. But
yeah. But he has to, throw himself out and save her, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's absolutely so, right on point.
Right. So all of that, I mean, believe me, Drift Class and I have a child like this at home.
Yes.
energy. Yeah. So we know this kid, and that's what makes this story so immediately relatable, even though it's science fiction, you know.
She's the one who hurt herself more frequently than everybody else.
Sure.
And there'd be, and every instinct in my body suddenly dropped back 3 million years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most protect, where? So infusing that into the story, mm-hmm. you know, it appears to be a single father. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not sure if he's single or if his wife is wherever they're going. We're not sure where they're going. Apparently, they're eventually going to end up on Mars. Apparently, it's pretty grave situation or important.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to keep it from her because, you know, he's hoping she has a good time. Maybe he's going to bury someone. Maybe he's going for a divorce. I don't know.
I get a sense of him being a scientist in some way and having to go to this other planet. But then why is he taking his 5-year-old with him? I mean, that's sort of a part of the problem here, I think, is he's got a 5-year-old on, as you said, what should be a very expensive trip.
Yeah,
and it's more like public transportation with families going on vacation.
Right.
I almost want, and again, this is first draft, initial opening of the story. You kind of probably need to clarify time and space and what this vacation is, and it might be that you decide to change the vehicle or the destination in some way so that it isn't necessarily interplanetary. Perhaps it's supersonic, but within the same planet, or a foreign planet, or in some other way to make it just less technologically distracting. I think that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to LaGrange Point Station, L5 or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
First of all, I don't think it would ever be called the Lagrangian Station. Things like that in space have names. You know, the USS Enterprise isn't called that big spaceship with the disc on its head. it's got a name. Everything in space has a name. So you're going to probably want to call it something. Explain in passing what it is. You're dealing with a science fiction crowd, so they know what you're talking about. But they're going to a particular place. They're going to the Grand Canyon or something in space. They're going to and it looks like it's a jumping off point for a longer trip. I'm guessing that's what that is. I'm guessing what's going on there. They're going to end up on Mars eventually. Maybe a terraforming trip because they're going to make it come back to life, which would be awesome. There is a rich tradition of juvenilia, which is not meant to slight the quality of the writing.
No.
The people who were targeted for this kind of writing were, you know, boys and girls ages 9 to 13 or whatever it might be. And you had the Rolling Stones. You had the Robert Heinlein put a lot of kids in space, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and young ladies and gentlemen. And that was the target audience for that story.
Right, right. And there is a huge audience out there now,
uh-huh.
The young adult audience. That's
exactly.
Not necessary. Might be a little older than the Heinlein juvenilia, Mm-hmm. Also might be more female. I'll just let you know. And so I think the relationship between this dad and his wife, or whoever he's seeing, whoever the is doing the parenting of this child, would be more to the liking of the audience and a publisher.
Yeah.
But you know, definitely there you will have no problem finding an audience for domestic fiction in space. Forget it. Yep. So you can get this published someplace. Yeah.
So here's a couple of sort of suggestions for the writer when it comes to getting it past an editor. First of all, I don't think anybody's going to buy that a spacecraft is going to be so loosey goosey that a 5-year-old can just run around and do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's way in the future and space travel is like riding a Greyhound bus.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Perhaps it is some sort of supersonic bus or some sort of point to point where, look, something's happened where part of the Earth is not available for habitation anymore.
Yep.
And so you wind up that becomes a whole new flyover country where to get to the store or to get to the farm or to get to something that's really necessary for life or to get to vacation, you actually have to fly in a public transport to get somewhere. And vacation becomes, because of climate change, you actually go from pole to pole, right?
Yeah. In a ballistic missile.
In a ballistic missile, you go pole to pole because those are the only inhabitable parts of the planet. And one part is for work and one part is for vacation. And that's the way they divided the Earth up with the remaining humans on planet Earth.
I do have one more suggestion. And I didn't float this past you, Blue Gal, but I want to ask. And this, I don't consider it a problem, but this does get you to the juvenilia audience, if that's where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it also provides a very useful dramatic dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Add a second child.
Ah.
An older brother or older sister.
Older
who is
sister.
Completely embarrassed by, by Elle.
Perfect.
And, you know, because while Dad's dealing with Jimmy, mm-hmm. Elle has slipped out of her webbing.
Yep.
Because she is like a friggin' eel.
If you make her the narrator, you're done. I mean, in terms of finding a market for this book, you're done.
Yep.
Sullen teen has to deal with Dad and the younger sister. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then she's going to a vacation spot where there's a boy. You're done.
You're done. And Mom is somewhere or not, but that's another dynamic you can play with to your heart's content.
Yep. But teen narrator, female teen narrator. Oh, my God.
And then you don't need any of that sort of internal understanding of ballistics,
right,
et cetera, that's sort of slowing the narrative down a little bit.
Right, right. It's just Dad's going to get slammed. Dad's going to try to save my stupid sister who can't sit still for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And
oh,
he
great.
Gets hurt.
She's embarrassing me again.
And and he's going to be bruised and sore, and I'm going to have to take care of my sister because he's not going to be able to tonight because he's going to be too sore from her banging into him. Yeah, I mean,
Dad's an idiot never fails to sell.
From commercials to large works of fiction, Dad's an idiot.
He's a scientist. And he's on an important thing, but he couldn't tell his kids about it.
Yeah.
But you can go anywhere with that kind of idea. And that really just occurred to me, like, there's a missing moment here. And the missing moment is there a third person in this family dynamic that can narrate the story, I think would really, and just as a thought experiment, try rewriting it like that if you'd like and see if that takes you where you want to go. But again, it's your story. Go with it. Go with God and do whatever you want with it.
Right.
I love the idea of parents having to travel with children in space.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Or in some sort of futuristic thing. Yeah. And we did say in space. So that's part of now we're dialing that topic back for him to fit this into the story. But part of it is the family dynamic that you have here is so clear and identifiable and relatable. And that is beautiful. That makes it a very readable story. So we want you to go on with that. The dad and the ballerina is something all of us have seen somewhere. And just one last thing is that when we say young adult fiction, I read young adult fiction all the time. So
it's really good.
Very popular. You know, John Green has made millions of dollars off of his young adult novels that are being turned into movies and made into, you know, screenplays, all kinds of things. So
and last year, I did the cheapest form of marketing research you could imagine.
You did. We talked about this, but yeah. Go ahead. For people that missed this earlier podcast.
We went to Middle Child's Book Fair.
Yeah, but it wasn't a book fair.
It was a literature fair.
It was a literature fair for the students
right. Who
had each read a book.
Yes. They had to read a book and they had to be able to and they had a fold-up display of
trifold
display.
Cardboard with a scrapbooking kind of element to it. What the elements of the story were, yeah.
The voice of write something in the voice of the narrator. Show what one of the recipes in the book look like if you cook it.
Mm-hmm. And it was one of these teaching exercises. I mean, for someone that like me who has a teaching certificate, mm-hmm. This is when you're looking for different kinds of learning styles, and you're trying to engage each type of learner. You know, the auditory learner. So you might pick a song that would have been played in the book. And then you have the artistic learner, and so the map would be something like that. You know, the person who has to get some sort of empathy, write a letter, like you say, write a letter in the voice of the character or the character's mother or whoever. Mm-hmm. And so going through and with each of these elements of their display, the teacher could point to different learning styles and make sure that they had reached each student at a core competency, as they would say, so that they'd be able to connect with the learning of the book and not just read the book and say, well, it's about a girl in space and she goes and she hates her dad and that's the end. Mm-hmm. You know, you really had to think about each element of the story. So we went through and saw 20 of these,
and
they're all reading. And by the way, there was also the book had to be approved by the teacher.
Yep.
Most cases, it was a book in the school library, so it had already gone through some sort of vetting process. Mm-hmm. And there was a length requirement. It had to be 250 to 300 pages, which is what these, you know, young adult novel type things, middle school level books are.
Yeah.
So we went through and saw 20 students doing it, each doing a different book.
Except they were all the same book.
They were all the same book.
In a certain way, they were all the same book.
Yep.
And this really was, oh, this is what sells. Oh, my God, this is what sells.
Yeah.
And, you know, so Amy, let me ask you, what's your character like? You know, well, she's a girl. How old is she? Well, she's a couple years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
Tweens or early teens, mm-hmm. Usually orphaned or in some other way an outsider. there is a terrible dark force that is ruining her world, and she must take up arms through being a better bow and arrow shot, being a better magician, being a better hacker. She will gather her nerd friends who are really good at their various things, and she will eventually overcome, or he will eventually overcome, this terrible threat to their world after volume 3 of this trilogy.
Hey, Jimmy, what's your book about? My book's about a football player who is an orphan. His dad died and his mom works 3 jobs. And he has a friend who lost his leg in a car accident. So
volume three,
he's an NFL player.
Okay. And Michelle, what's your book about? My book's about a young girl about my age, maybe a little bit older, who discovers that she has magical powers. And her kingdom is threatened by a dark, evil lord from, you know, Trantor or wherever. And it's all the same story.
And now, she flies around on a dragon.
Yeah.
But when she gets home, her best friend is there and is mad at her about the dragon. And so
that happens.
She learns a valuable lesson.
But
she also has to defeat the evil Gwark. I mean, it's the same story.
This does not detract from the quality of the writing of each book at all.
Yeah, yeah. Or the wide variety of quality of writing. But, I mean, I think, you know, some of them are going to be written much better than others.
And some of them were by very famous writers.
Yeah.
Who have figured out, oh, this is a genre that sells like friggin' hotcakes.
I can fund my kids' college education if I just write 3 of these. Okay.
But that's the deal. You have to be able to write 3 or 4 of them.
Yep.
Every one of these, well, almost without exception, was a trilogy or a quology.
Yeah.
That's the model. There is absolutely right now, the publishing industry is, you know, in collapse.
For kids' books.
Except for this genre. You either have to be Oprah or Stephen King or nobody, mm-hmm. except for this genre. Except for this genre is extremely welcoming and profitable. I'm sure it'll be saturated at some point, but there really is a market for your story out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so go for it, man. Just make sure you have three novels worth before you start writing.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll be back next week with more Science Fiction University. Yay!
Yay!
I love you, Drift Class.
I love you, Blue Gal. Bye.
Bye.